This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good morning. Thank you for joining me for another exciting episode of New Book Network's African American Studies podcast. I am your host, Katrina Anderson. Today, I am joined by Dr. Ilion Wu, who is the New York Times bestselling author of The Great Divorce, a 19th century mother's extraordinary fight against her husband, the Shakers, and her time. Her writing has appeared in the Boston Globe, the Wall Street Journal, Times Magazine, and the New York Times. And she has received support for her research from the Whiting Foundation, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the American Antiquarian Society, among other institutions. She has a BA in the Humanities from Yale College and a PhD in English from Columbia University. Today, we will be discussing her new book, Master Slave, Husband, Wife, An Epic Journey from Slavery to Freedom, which is a bestseller already, and it is a fabulous book. So thank you for joining me today, Dr. Wu.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for that lovely introduction.
So this book, I want to say, it has been labeled one of the top picks for 2023. I will say, in my own perspective, it is a masterful book. It is so well done. So can you give us a little bit, can you tell us a little bit about the book?
Sure. Well, this is the Master Slave Husband Wife. I didn't actually title it with the craft names in it because I wanted it to give the flavor of something a little bit different than a biography, a straightforward biography. It's the story of William and Ellen Craft, an enslaved couple, and they flee bondage in 1848. They move from Macon, Georgia, traveling through multiple states up to the north, finally arriving in Philadelphia on Christmas Eve. And they do it with the most extraordinary disguise. So they are actually husband and wife, but they act as master and slave, with Ellen, who is very fair-complected, passing as white and acting as a wealthy, disabled male enslaver, and William pretending to be her slave. And it's about their extended journey to freedom, which ostensibly ends when they get to Philadelphia, but actually in many ways, that's just another beginning.
You know, it's so... Their journey is so fascinating in how they accomplish their freedom. Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you, how did you learn about the crafts?
I was very lucky to have been assigned this narrative in graduate school. So I was studying literature. We were reading actually way too much theory in most of my other classes. I was like, I thought I signed up for reading stories, not reading about stories. But this class was an amazing class. It's taught by Robert O'Mealy. I think he might even still be teaching variations on this class today. And it was on the literature of passing. And it was just kind of one of those indelible reading experiences, one that I will just never forget. I remember the look of the page. I remember where I was when I read the narrative. I just was at the edge of my seat. So it really all began there in graduate school.
And what made you decide to write about them?
That's an interesting question, because that took a lot longer. I mean, I was in graduate school over 20 years ago, and the story kept coming back to me. So, you know, it's like an adventure story. It's a love story with some really vivid detail that is kind of unusual for the genre. A lot of self-emancipated writers like The Crafts actually chose to deliberately obscure parts of their story and not tell it, both to protect themselves and loved ones left behind. But The Crafts reveal a lot, and they really have these scenes where they sort of bring you into the moment of their journey. But there are a lot of things that they don't tell, that they can't or won't tell, and they leave out. And it's pretty, you can feel those gaps and those silences in the narrative. So as I said, this is a long epic journey, and it almost has sort of like three arcs to it. The first arc would be the journey from Macon, Georgia to Philadelphia, but the journey doesn't stop there, because they end up becoming celebrities on the abolitionist lecture circuit, and then the fugitive slave law passes, and slave hunters come up for them from Georgia. So that's sort of the second act, the crisis in the North. And then a third act comes actually when they have to go overseas and escape from America. So just to give you the story in a nutshell a little bit further, that's it. The three arcs, journey out of the South, crisis in the North, and journey out of America and into the UK. So if you look at The Crafts' narrative, the one that I originally read, the story that introduced me to The Crafts, they really focus on the first leg. And then they give... they narrate their escape out of the United States, but there are huge parts that are obviously missing, including the major chase in Boston and just about everything that happens afterwards. So all those questions, I guess, are what sort of kept drawing me back. Like, I wanted to know what their lives were like in bondage. They don't give very much of the before. They don't give very much of the after of the escape. And so I guess my writing journey really began with an archival research journey, which began with this kind of obsessive curiosity about, well, who were they, and what brought them to this point? What made them do this? And how did they eventually use their freedom? Questions like that just kept coming back to me again and again. And I guess the questions are what made me want to write the story.
That makes a lot of sense, because as you mentioned, as you read that actual narrative that they created, it is like a snapshot in time, mm-hmm. and you are following them on their epic journey. But as you said, there's no before and there's really no after. You're like in that moment. So I can see how that would make you, rightfully so, want to explore to find out what prompted them to go to these lengths to escape, and what was their life? What was their life after, you know, after they get to the North? And was that like the end of the story? Is that where it ends? But no, as you said, there's that other arc that picks up from that. And so I want to ask you, how challenging was the research process to do this? And most especially connected to that, finding Ellen Craft as a Black woman, as you know, Black women's history is extremely difficult to do.
Yes.
How challenging was it to go through the research process for this book?
Well, there were definitely many challenges involved, but, you know, honestly, I have never had a research experience like this before where things have continually unfolded as they have. In fact, there have been more recent unfoldings that I am now, like, I've written into the paperback edition, which is coming out in the new year. But I guess I'll answer the question in two parts. So the challenge actually in many ways comes from the contrast between a huge abundance in some areas of research. Like, I just felt like there were windfalls everywhere, and then a dearth on the other. So I'll start with the abundance. Just to give an example, you know, we were talking about how the crafts do narrate that journey. But they're sort of really giving the storyline and the scenes, which is great, but they're not really turning the camera outside. So you're seeing, like, exactly where they are. They're sort of stating the different places they pass through. And one thing that I really wanted to do is sort of conjure that experience with all the five senses, right? So you can get a sense of what it felt like and smelled like and looked like and tasted like to live in that time and place. So we can really see, you know, we can really sort of try to be there as much as possible in the moment along that journey. So it's like taking a camera and just and focusing on them, but also showing everything sort of behind. And that really changes the story. And in terms of that, like, there was a huge amount of information that I could find through travel logs. The crafts might not say what they were eating or where they had to go to, you know, to use the facilities or how they changed trains. But there are people who write about these things. So that stuff was really abundant. In fact, I found records from William Craft's enslaver's son, Hugh Craft, describing a leg of the journey, of his own journey, that overlapped with, it's like basically he took the same route that the crafts had. And he's talking about what he's seeing on the boat, on the steamboat, what he's having to eat, like what this place like smells and feels like. So being able to draw from those sort of sideways resources was abundant and exhilarating. In contrast to that, I mean, so for somebody like Henry Craft, Hugh Craft's son, or the Crafts enslavers, you can get very, like, really granular about their lives, about their experiences, about their histories. I found more than I ever expected that I could, for example, about Ellen Craft's initial enslaving mistress. So maybe I should pull back for a second to say that Ellen Craft was a daughter of an enslaved woman named Maria and also her first enslaver. So her biological father was her first enslaver. And her biological father had a wife and a legal wife and many children at the same time. And this legal wife was so enraged by the sight of Ellen's physical resemblance to her own family and to her husband that she had Ellen given away as a wedding present when she was 11. So one of the things I was really interested in trying to do is uncover more behind that story. And in the process, I found incredible information about this woman, Mistress Smith, which was important to me because I wanted to make her, evoke her as a full human being and not just kind of a caricature, because that's too easy to do that. And then we can dismiss the history so much more easily. But in contrast, it's so much more difficult to find information about the enslaved, about Ellen Craft's mother. There's such an imbalance. And that is really, you know, circling back to the root of your question, that was one of the biggest challenges, is trying to see Ellen and trying to see her mother.
That makes a lot of sense because, you know, those archives, as you said, there's blank spaces sets there. You're reading against the grain to try to get what tidbits you can to construct.
Yes.
Their narrative. You're trying to, you know, give them a voice when most often theirs is muted. There's just not the archival research that you want. But you did an excellent job of bringing Ellen and her mother out into this book. So for that, I appreciate, and I'm sure many other scholars appreciate that as well. And I wanted to ask you, you know, mm-hmm. you have research, but also writing. The book is flawless. I mean, you have a gift as a writer. So how was the writing process? for this book?
I'm thank you so much for that really high praise. I wish I could like time travel and show that, like send that clip to myself, you know, the version of me that was toiling at this and thinking, oh, this is never, ever going to work, because it was definitely what you're seeing is sort of the tip of the iceberg, to use the Hemingway, you know, metaphor. There's a lot of frozen stuff underneath the surface of what you see in the finished product, a lot of thrown away pages. It felt on the one hand very organic once I found my rhythm, but it also was really challenging. I think the main thing that was so challenging is that I found all this research, all this new information, you know, for example, about the Ellen and William Craft's experiences in bondage, the people in their lives before they left, you know, and trying to figure out how to incorporate all that sort of essentially backstory. I mean, you might call it backstory, but to me, it really was also on the forefront of their journey. How to weave that into a forward moving narrative. It was a process that took many, many, many steps. So if there is a feeling of fluency in the end, that's really a dream come true for me to hear that.
It was. It is. I can definitely say that it was most definitely well put together. And it's like you have this, you know, you're starting before they're on their journey, but you're interweaving everything that's going along. And mm-hmm. So it is flawless as you are reading this. You keep going back saying, oh, wow. You know, I said, oh, wow, so many times as I was reading, because it's just, it is so well written and so well done. And I want to congratulate you. And it's also easy to read, which is also another definite plus, as a historian, that is not always the case. So I want to commend you on that.
Thank you. Yeah, it was, I think one big thing, hurdles that I was facing is that I have this academic background, which has given me a lot of the skills to do the kind of research that a book like this requires. But in academia, or the way that you're asked to write academically, it's like you start with your argument, you lay out your argument, you present the information up front. And narrative nonfiction is really kind of the opposite. You don't want to be telling people, this is what I'm going to say, and this is what you want to think. Suspense comes from the reader asking questions, and you answering them as they go along, but sort of pulling them along so they're getting more questions even as they're moving forward. So it kind of took a lot of sort of undoing. And the big one piece of advice, actually, that my first editor for my previous book gave me that I've continued to carry through with this. His name is Alex Littlefield, but he gave me the advice that information has to be given as a slow release. So you don't have like an earlier draft that I had like big sort of dumps of background information and history. And what Alex's advice had to do with is just giving just enough, just what the reader needs to know at the moment, and not feeling like you have to explain everything at once. So once I kind of got that working, then it became super fun.
I know. And it looks like it. As you're reading along, there is that suspense there, because you're like, what's going to happen next? You're on the edge of your seat as you are going through reading, because you anticipate and you're trying to figure out in your mind, what's the next move? And it was just like a page turner. I can definitely say that what's happening. So let's dive into the book a little bit. We talked about Ellen. Mm-hmm. What about William? You know, who was William Craft? About how old was he? You know, is there a beginning on this journey? What was his life like?
Yeah, so both Crafts were in their early 20s. They were super young when they were on this journey, but they also, you know, his journey also in many ways began in his childhood with a pretty seminal moment, which is kind of the emotional heart of the original narrative, which is the moment at which he is auctioned off and sold away from his younger sister. So maybe I should give a little bit more of an overview here before we sort of get to that pivotal moment. William Craft writes about being enslaved by a man who he only identifies by the name Craft. And I was able to actually find a lot more about this this man named Craft. His name is Hugh Craft. He tells about how when he in his childhood, this man, Hugh Craft, sold off his parents and mortgaged, sold off each one of William's siblings one by one, and mortgaged William and his actually a brother and also a sister, because he was basically gambling in cotton, speculating, and lost a lot of money. So William narrates the experience of these losses, particularly focusing on his parting, his forced separation from his sister, his younger sister, who I also found a bit more information about, when they were both sold, or the expression back then is called, is knocked down on the courthouse steps in Macon, Georgia. So in that moment, he has to sort of improvise, call upon every sort of sense of self-preservation, performance that he can in this moment when he himself is being sold and he's looking at his sister being driven off who knows where by her new owner. And this is a moment that really, I think, catapults him into feeling the necessity that he needs to escape bondage one day. When they're separated, you know, as I said, that he was mortgaged. He was also apprenticed to a cabinet maker, and these are skills that that he used. He and Ellen were able to take advantage of not only to earn money to be able to go on this journey, to afford this journey, but also, excuse me, also he's able to create a chest in which he's hiding. He and Ellen are hiding, locking away the different parts of the costume that they will be able to use on their escape. So I'm a little bit all over the place there, but that's sort of William's background in a nutshell. He's a skilled cabinet maker, an artisan who's experienced this devastating trauma in his childhood, who is determined to seek a new life with his new love, Ellen.
And he does. And it's so interesting because they become a couple together, and they are in Macon, Georgia. So if you could say a little bit about Macon, you know, what was their environment like during this time?
Yeah, Macon is a really interesting place. And I did a deep dive into that history. I mean, Macon was really kind of up and coming right at this time. And it kind of came of age as a city, as Ellen was coming of age. So you have originally this was sacred indigenous ground, and actually you can visit the Okmulgee Mounds today. They're pretty incredible. The railroads ended up cutting through those grounds. There's like a huge transformation in this territory, in the space, from the 1820s through the 1840s and beyond, when the Crafts were there. You have the removal, the dispossession of the Muscogee Creek people, and then you have this really rapidly rising commercial center. So that's what Ellen and William both come into when they're, William when he's about 10 years old, actually Ellen too when she's about 11, they're coming into this new territory for white American settlers. They are coming into a place that is really kind of on a transportation, on the cusp of a transportation revolution. It's, you know, there are like hogs roaming in the street, and it's still sort of disorganized, but it's also all these incredible grand houses are going up now that people who've made fortune are making their fortunes in cotton and other markets are building. It's real. It's like a college, a women's college is being founded at that time. It's a time and place of incredible growth. And what the Crafts experience there is actually urban bondage versus the plantation slavery that the Crafts are oftenly sort of mistaken for having experienced. That was actually very different from their experiences in Macon.
Right, because they're in this urban environment where there is, you know, they're not isolated. You know, they're in the thick of things, as you would say. You know, everything is happening around them for the most part. And they're, you know, there's a lot of interaction. There's a lot of hustle and bustle during this. And they're involved in that. You know, they are enslaved, but, you know, they still have tasks and things that they are engaging in for their owners.
Yes. They have an inside view. Like if you think, so the escape that they make simply would not have been possible even 5 years earlier, right? Even 5 years earlier, there was no railroad. There were only steamboats and stages and overland ways of getting around. But actually Ellen Craft's enslaver, or technically her biological half-sister is her legal enslaver, but her husband, Robert Collins, was actually a railroad entrepreneur. So he is credited with having played a major role in building the very railroad line that the Crafts will take to escape from Georgia. It's pretty amazing. And they have inside access knowledge that they wouldn't have had if they weren't in the particular situations that they inhabited. So when you think about like what kinds of conversations Ellen is able to overhear in the house, having to do with transportation, having to do with how you get on the railroads, when you think about William, who not only worked independently in a cabinet maker shop, but was also working at a hotel, he's also hearing conversations and getting snippets of information here and there. And they use all of this. They're able to harness all of this knowledge that they are gleaning for this incredible escape.
And it is incredible at that. And as one would say, timing is everything because, you know, they are escaping. It's 1848. There is so much going on both domestically and also internationally at the same time that this has happened. As you mentioned a moment ago, you've got the transportation revolution is going on. You've got print revolution. All of these things are happening simultaneously as, you know, they're about to begin their epic journey. You know, 1848. And I cannot stress how important timing was for them doing this because, you know, strategically everything was planned out because they are able to leave. And this is where I'll let you jump in. It's a very strategic time of the year and they're able to actually make this escape as to why. How are they able to actually leave during this period?
Well, it is pretty key that it is holiday time, which is generally a time when enslavers were more inclined to give visiting traveling passes to the favorites among those they enslaved. And that a pass like that is absolutely required. I mean, if you get there, you know, you can look at the statute laws of Georgia that specify what can happen to you if you're caught without such a written pass. So they plan this strategically right before Christmas, right when they'll be able to get these passes. And, you know, they make up an excuse of Ellen's aunt being sick and having to go stay and visit. And because they're trusted, they have maybe something like 3 days, which is actually not enough to get them all the way to the north, but far enough that they hope they can make it.
Right. And that is so true. And it's so interesting. Once they have gotten that pass, then, you know, it's okay. Here's our plan and we have to enact it. And it's interesting. Ellen has to transform into Mr. Johnson. But, you know, it's strategically they have planned out possible scenarios as to what could possibly happen and how to actually go around that. Because as an enslaved person, Ellen can't exactly write. So they come up with ways to say, okay, we can avoid that. We will say that she is disabled or Mr. Johnson is disabled. And, you know, it is such a masterful performance that they enact that it's logically they've thought out all of the possible scenarios of what could happen on this journey. And even as they did that, it's interesting, as they are leaving, there's one that they had not initially thought of that causes them anxiety, you know, as they're boarding the train. Can you speak about that? That was like the first like harrowing experience, like right there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it really is, you know, it had me at the edge of my seat, even though I knew it was going to happen, you know, and obviously we know that they're going to make it. It's really that, how are they going to get themselves out of this one, you know? And it starts immediately as soon as they get to the train station, because they end up encountering not one, not two, but three different people who could easily recognize them. And it was mind blowing. They talk about two of them in their narrative. And maybe I'll just tell the first one, because that's the one that really kind of gets your heart thumping. But, you know, they have gone their separate ways into Macon. Ellen comes later. William gets there first to get into what's called the Negro car, and he's hiding there. Ellen buys the tickets and gets settled into the passenger train car. And right outside is the cabinet maker, with whom William has been working since he was a child, since he was apprenticed as a child. This man, it turns out, has this weird intuition, this kind of sixth sense that something is up with William. And so he actually comes to the train station, and he comes within, like, I mean, he actually passes Ellen, and thank goodness. I mean, I'll let the book reveal the sort of like the action packed sequence, but it is really a stunning moment when this man shows up, and that's just the beginning.
Yeah, you're literally, audience, you were literally on the edge of your seats as you were reading this, because you're like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? And it's almost one of those where you have that moment where you don't want to know, but then you do want to know, but you're like caught between the two, because you're just so anxious, because you feel the anxiety, because you're thinking, oh my gosh, what's going to happen right now? So, and this is what William and Ellen were experiencing, mm-hmm. as they were going throughout this journey to claim freedom. And, you know, there are other moments that in there that you will read about in the book. And then, you know, they're also, as they're undertaking this journey, they're passing by, you know, so many places that are connected to slavery. You know, mm-hmm. they're passing by the slave market that's in Georgia, in Savannah, that's famous. And, you know, I can only imagine, you know, what their feelings must be as they are passing by these places that are so heavily connected to slavery, as they are going out, you know. And then, of course, we're in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. So, you know, even though this is a 5,000-mile journey that they're in, there are many twists and turns that are happening there. You know, they arrive in Philadelphia, but they don't stay. So where do they head, Dr. Wu? Where are they going next after Philadelphia?
Well, the original plan was Canada. That would have really been the safest thing. And then the book would have probably ended after about 10 pages or something like that. You know, maybe that would have been happily ever after. They go to Canada. I don't know. They had to like St. Catharines or something like that. And they change their names and they start their new lives. But no, the Crafts are just, I mean, they are storytellers, not only with the way they speak, but in the way they are constantly shifting the narrative of their lives. And they're always making like the most difficult possible choice. So they arrive in Philadelphia. They're told that it's not safe, and they're physically like exhausted and unwell. At the same time, abolitionists, activists are like, once they get wind of the story, they are like, oh my gosh, this is going to be incredible PR. And look at these like gorgeous, like incredibly well-spoken potential celebrity lecturers. They ask William and Ellen, specifically William Wells Brown asks William and Ellen Craft if they will take their story on the lecture circuit. So this is what they do, and it's such a huge risk that they take upon themselves, because you know, as they travel, as they advertise where they're going, it's like putting a marker on their back. People can, their enslavers can trace them, and they do. They are following. I found evidence for them, like, following along as crafts are traveling yet another 1,000 miles all over New England, across the North, like crisscrossing and speaking night after night. It's really an incredible another chapter in their journey.
You know, and they settle kind of like in the midst. They're at the hubbub of activity in Boston. You know, that is kind of almost the, well, it is the center of the anti-slavery movement because, you know, they're lecturers, they're interacting, you know, with William Wells Brown, William Lord Garrison, and they do become these two big celebrities, and rightfully so, from their experience. But yet, you know, it's almost they're in plain sight, as you say, of everyone who is hunting them. During this time. But then, of course, there's that big outside factor, which is the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850, which changes the dynamic for them at that point.
Absolutely.
And it's there that you begin to see, okay, you know, we're in the North, but that's not enough anymore for them. Because at that point, you know, and what you so masterfully did, you brought in, you know, how that one law brought into so many people who become involved, who are, you know, you're thinking about this time, Henry Clay, Daniel Webster, you've got President Fillmore, all these people because of this one law and its impact on the crafts during this time. Can you speak about how that law reshaped things for them?
Yeah, I mean, this was a devastating law as passed as part of this, you know, great compromise. I mean, we compromise as a nation repeatedly, and this was a huge one. It empowers enslavers as never before. There had been a Fugitive Slave Act before, but as it's often described, it was still like toothless. This actually gives a major bite for enslavers and the crafts enslavers who have not done anything up until this time, despite the embarrassment of seeing the crafts like tell their story all over the country, see it all over the news and everything like that. At this point, they're like, okay, we've got some power. Let's go. And at that point, again, the crafts could have left. The crafts, everyone, you know, their friends are saying, get out of here. You guys are in grave danger. Go to Canada. You know, that you're going to have like a bounty on your head because you're so well known. But they say, that's exactly why we need to stay. And both sides dig in because the enslavers are like, we want this to be a test case of this new law. And the crafts are like, we want this to be a test case for freedom. And of course, that's what leads to this like climactic, this climax in Boston where they're being hunted down. I guess I want to emphasize that point that you also made, which is that it's not just sort of like a North, slavery is not a North versus South institution. It's an American institution. And nowhere do you feel that more than in this part of the craft's journey, because it's really in Boston, ironically, that the crafts are in the greatest danger, that they are actually chased and hunted down as enslaved people.
Right. And that's that, you know, that's such a big irony. It is. It's an American story that the two are enduring during this period. But they eventually leave, because that leads us to the, you know, next arc, which is they're going to England. And of course, as they journey across the Atlantic, they become celebrities over there as well during this period. And they're entering, you know, the lecture circuit. But it's just not publicly that they're also using this time to pursue their own personal goals that they wanted to do. So can you speak a little bit about their life in England?
Yeah, you're very right about their personal goals, and that's actually one of the main that's the main reason why I wanted to write that last part of the story, because this is the point at which they start to have choice. They can decide what freedom will look like for them, how they want to live. Actually, in my original proposal for the book, I had the story ending because I wanted to give all that, like, you know, sensory detail. I thought I could only sustain it until they reached English shores. And that's where the story ends, because the question of their freedom, you know, are they safe from bondage? That seems to be answered as soon as they land there. But no, there's this other dimension, just how are they going to live in this place that is so completely different from the U.S. and yet also has its own issues, its own problems. I guess I'll just say that there's not a straight and clear path once they go to the UK either. They have their like a whole host of different kinds of issues, both with on the abolitionist lecture circuit, where they're sort of like politics that they haven't encountered in quite the same way, and also as they're trying to decide what do they really want for themselves. There are definitely white activists and patrons who want to support a certain vision of their freedom, but that's not what they want. And that's, again, where they take incredibly bold and brave steps to define their life narrative on their own terms.
And that they do. I mean, it's a journey that as they're going along, it's continuously evolving and re-evolving into mm-hmm. something else. But they want, for the crafts, it's so important that they have a say, their own say in what they want for their lives, rather than whether it's the enslavers, whether it's, you know, those on the abolitionist lecture circuit. It's important for them to make their own decisions, you know, as to what they want their lives to look like. And that's for both William and for Ellen Craft. Yes. You know, for her, I know it's really important. I remember there's one, you know, source that where they're talking about, oh, yes, you know, she wishes she had remained in the United States as a slave. And it's, you know, that's one of those pieces of evidence, you know, you see where she refutes that notion.
Yeah.
Wholeheartedly, no, I do not want to remain enslaved in Georgia. That's not the life that I wanted for myself. And it's so ironic, you know, as they're trying to say, no, you're not doing better off as a free person. That makes very little sense. And, you know, Ellen Craft, your voice may be more muted on the English shores, but it's not completely silent.
Oh yeah, definitely not. But what I think there, you know, there was a tendency for people to assume that she was quiet because she was silenced, or because she was somehow being dominated by the two Williams, not only William Craft, but William Wells Brown, who also was a very good speaker and loved to tell stories and all that. But I think her quiet comes from a place of power, and that itself is a choice. And when she chooses to speak, she can be acerbic, she can be witty, she can be, you know, she shows her own brand of strength and power.
I agree. And she's strategic.
Mm-hmm.
She actually knows what works well. She also can read the environment and the landscape as to what will be expected of her. And
yes,
that's something that she learned from that performance as Mr. Johnson and as an enslaved woman in Macon, Georgia. She was able to perfect the art of performing who she needs to be at that moment in time.
Yes.
And that public performance for her, you know, you think often about, yes, you're striving to get an Academy Award, an Oscar. For Ellen Craft, it was a performance of a lifetime that gave her her freedom, which was so important for both her and William. And she knew how to read others to see what they wanted from her.
Yes. I love the way you say read, because it is a form of literacy. I mean, we haven't, you know, talked about too much about literacy, but this is something that's, you know, denied, something that she very much wants. But she has all these different ways of reading a room, reading people's expressions, reading their body language. That form of literacy, as well as the literal form of literacy, which she later gains, those are instrumental for her. And people often ask, like, or wonder, you know, how is it that she was able to pull off this incredible performance on the road and beyond? But when you think back to, I mean, what is performance but the projection of an outward persona that's at odds or different from what you're experiencing from within? That's something she had no choice but to do from when she was a child, when she, you know, for example, was separated from her mother, or forced to perform in the household in different ways. I mean, that was an excruciating, incredibly highly fraught lover of performance that she had to do in her childhood. So everything else afterwards, I mean, I think, I mean, not that you can compare them relatively, but it draws from that strength that she has in knowing who she is on the inside, and also being able to protect herself from what's going on the outside.
And that she does. She masterfully does it over and over again. And I don't want to spoil anything for readers, because I want them to go out and pick up a copy of this book, because they will be on the edge of their seats as they are learning about William and Ellen Craft's epic journey. And it is. So I want to ask you now, you know, in England, I will say this, it's not the end of their journey. So let's just leave it at that. So readers, listeners, please go out to, and there's so much we have not covered, so that you can find out more about this. You know, I want to ask you, and this is something that you were able to do. You were able to connect with the descendants of the Crafts, which I think is awesome. I mean, to actually be able to do that. So what was that like for you?
It's honestly been one of the best parts of my journey with the Crafts and with this book. They are incredibly generous, wise, interesting family members who I have encountered. I've met a number of them now. I was primarily in touch with one during the writing of this book. But I think one particular memory that I will never forget is going to William Craft's gravesite with three of his great-great-grandchildren, three of his great-great-granddaughters. It was pretty extraordinary standing there and being able to pay my respects with these descendants for whom really the Crafts did, you know, they were a large part of why the Crafts embarked on this incredible journey that they did. They did it for each other and for their love, but also for their progeny. And I think about this deed that I found, the legal document by which Ellen Craft's biological father and first enslaver gave her away as this wedding present to her own biological half-sister. And in this, he talks about, or he consigns not only Ellen, but her increase and all future generations, her future generations, her lineage, which also happens to be his biological lineage. He consigns them all to bondage, all to the bondage of Eliza Collins and her progeny. So the Crafts broke that chain, and to see all the gifts that they passed down reflected in these, you know, incredible family members who very generously have shared so many of their stories and their archival materials at the Avery Research Center. It's just it's really beautiful to behold.
I can only imagine. You know, you're seeing everything that you wrote about standing there beside you. You know, this is what their journey was about. Mm-hmm. It was about securing their freedom for themselves and their future generations. That was, you know, that's just a surreal moment to be able to take that in at that point in time. So I want to ask you, what do you want readers to take away from the book?
I would really just love more people to recognize the Crafts as being American heroes in a time when there's so many different arguments about what American history is and what we should be teaching, what we should be learning. I think their story is a uniquely American story that both shows their individual heroism and also in heroism that's representative, I think, of our country's best spirit.
I agree with that. I agree. They are truly American in so many ways. And they are heroes. Mm-hmm. You know, they took incredible risks for themselves, but also for future generations. It just wasn't their journey. It was a journey that they undertook for others as well. So I agree with your sentiments on that. And one last little thing. Are you working on anything new right now?
I have some ideas on the back burner, but they're still percolating. And for now, I mean, it's been a very active new kind of storytelling experience for me to share about the craft story on the road. And that's going to continue. I'm going to have many more sort of public events coming up in the new year, the release of the paperback. And then I'll be ready to write again.
Sounds great. I look forward to your next book that you have. Thank you so much for joining me today, Dr. Wu, to discuss your magnificent new book, Master Slave, Husband, Wife.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a really great pleasure talking with you.
Readers, listeners, please go out and pick up a copy of Master Slave, Husband, Wife, An Epic Journey from Slavery to Freedom. It is on sale now, and I assure you, you will not regret picking up this book. It is one of the top books of 2023. It is so well done. You will be on the edge of your seats. It's like when you're in the movie theater and you're watching the movie and you want to know what happens next. This is what is happening in this book. So please, I urge you, go out and pick up a copy of this book today.